This recording is a production of Anabaptist Financial. More recordings are available on our website at www.afweb.org under the Resources menu or by calling 800-653-9817. This presentation was recorded at a Deacon and Trustees Seminar held on July 21, 2026 in Ephrata, Pennsylvania.
Good afternoon. Greet you in the name of Jesus. Nurturing stewardship discussions is the topic that was assigned to me. And I don't come to you here this afternoon in a position of authority, but more a position of humility. And perhaps I don't have a lot of answers, but maybe we can have conversations and discussions around this. So maybe you can listen in as I wrestle through this topic of how do we be good stewards? Can we have the difficult discussions in our brotherhoods? If you see resources, money, and time flowing somewhere that gives you pause in your brotherhood, do you have a vehicle to have conversations that are upbuilding and helpful? Or maybe it is wealth flowing to self. You have a way to speak into that that is redemptive, that helps. You know what? I never thought about that. Thank you for bringing it up. On the other hand, perhaps you're seeing resources flow to the poor, those that have not been given the opportunities that you and I have been given. How do you say that's wonderful? Can we do more of that? Earl Peachey this morning said, our abundance causes him to tremble, and I connect with that. When I travel to the developing countries, I see tremendous suffering and need. And yet, when I come home, I see abundance. What pleases God? None of us chose where we were going to be born. Earl also said, we contribute best by our example and influence, and that's an humbling thought, and I believe that's true. And then David Swigert's topic on this biblical intent of the alms fund. And I wrote down one word, or I wrote down the poor. Is it possible we have confused what the alms fund is? Is it for the poor? I think that's what it says. But this is simply a tool to help local churches to become better stewards. I'd like to, assist in our journey of becoming better biblical stewards, both those struggling with wealth and those struggling with excess spending and debt, both of those extremes is what we want to help in that journey. On your programs, it says, I think the tagline says something about adversity and prosperity. Those are both important elements. And my goal this afternoon here is have you leave here equipped and excited to invest in your local brotherhood using this teaching course as a meaningful tool, not as a once and done, we check the box, now I did this, but rather as an ongoing learning, bite-sized, so, you know, next winter we'll do it again, and we keep doing that. I'd like to look into this topic in four areas. Start with why finances. How and what did Jesus teach in the Gospels? Have we become distracted from the biblical target? And then talk about the course a little bit. You have the books in front of you. And then our worldview problem, look into that just a bit. And then the local brotherhood, you actually have the gifts in your brotherhood, and outside experts not required. So we'll start with why finances. Managing our money is connected to most areas of our lives. Holistic approach, physical and spiritual, is what we're trying to do. Why should a church leader be concerned about this subject? Is this subject even important? Jesus said this, where our heart is where our treasure goes. Matthew 6:21. Now, I've noticed in my own life, I'd like to flip that around and say, this is where my heart is, and separate it from where my time and money goes, but I don't believe that's possible. In fact, Jesus said it's not. And if I was trying to diagram that, where my time and money goes, then that tells me what's in my heart. So as you look at that question mark, think about your own life. I think about my life. Think about your congregations. What is in that picture for you? Is it hunting? Is it, I don't know, fill in the blank, costly vacation, expensive vehicles? What about your youth? As you think about the youth in your home congregation, just get a picture of someone, what would the picture be? And then you know what's in their hearts. That's what Jesus said. On the other hand, maybe the box would be filled with serving others, the local homeless, the needy. This can help answer what type of churches we are. I'd like to take just a few moments and learn from the master teacher as we engage in these sometimes difficult conversations. How did Jesus do this? What did the master teacher do to impart truth to his listeners? As a church leader, I'm sure you're concerned about that. One thing, and it depends on the Bible verse, the Bible version you look at, but get the overall picture here. There's approximately 500 verses in the New Testament about prayer. There's approximately about that same amount, 500 verses on faith, and about four times that many on money and possessions. Now, what can we learn from that? God cares about our finances. 1 out of 10 verses in the gospel deals directly with the subject of money. Of the 38 parables Jesus told, 16 refer to handling money and possessions. If the divine master spent this much time talking about our resources, we can be pretty sure God cares about this. And we should sit up and take notice. But let's look at some of Jesus' methods. He used language that his audience understood. He told stories and scenes and the meanings, and he used normal daily language, language that we all know. He also used stories and examples, object lessons, proverbs in a story form, something close at hand. If you think of one of Jesus' proverbs and he has pictures in that story, you can be 100% certain that the people he was speaking to understood what those things meant. Now, I'm looking for interaction here. Any guess on what percentage of Jesus' total words were in parable form from a percentage? Any ideas? Yes? 90? No, not that many. Very close. About a third of his total words were in parable form. Let's look at a few others. Jesus asked how many questions in all the Gospels? And again, you could go one way or the other in these things a little bit, but get the main message from how he taught. How many questions did Jesus ask in all the Gospels? Any idea? Just a number. 168 more, a lot more. Anybody else? That's close. 339 questions. Let's look at another question thing. Now, people ask Jesus questions how many times? Any guesses? 75 more. Not that many. Somewhere around 183 questions is what when people ask Jesus questions in the Gospels. Here's probably the most notable thing from this little exercise. When, of those 183 times, how many times do you think Jesus responded with a direct answer? A little more than never, 8 times. Here's an example. The lawyer, what must I do to inherit eternal life? Well, Jesus could have just told him, but he didn't. He said, what do you read? And the lawyer told him the long list, and he said, you've answered correctly. But then he said, and love your neighbor. And I can almost see the attorney. He's probably walking away. Oh, wait, who's my neighbor? The man on the left and the man on the right. I got this. Jesus could have just said, everybody you run into, but he didn't. You know what he did next? He launched into the parable of the Good Samaritan. And then at the very end, he said, go and do likewise. And that parable has blessed mankind, all the Christian faith ever since. Now, do you think we'd be reading and talking about this if Jesus would have just said, gave him an answer immediately? Beautiful way of teaching. So as we interact with others in our churches asking hard questions about how to steward our wealth, can we use these illustrations? The rich young ruler is another. Sell what you have and give to the poor. In the parable, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than a wealthy man to enter the kingdom of heaven. There's many illustrations all through the Gospels how Jesus taught. Can we do it similar? Now, if we want to be good stewards, if we want to be faithful in this, do we have the resources we need? Let's look at a 100-year spread here, what I'm calling beyond necessities. In 1918, the average family spent about 84% of household income on food, clothing, and shelter, leaving about 16% for entertainment and miscellaneous. Any ideas what it is 100 years later? 100 years later, in 2016, this is dated a little bit, we spend only 38% on food, clothing, and shelter, leaving 62% for discretionary spending. That's sobering. Now, I understand every budget's different. Money is opportunity. We have unprecedented financial opportunity to bless others. People are richer today than ever, yet feel poor. And I would suggest this afternoon, if we look to the surrounding culture to determine what we should do, we'll move with them. Let's look at another thing. We need to be talking about this. This is something that I believe everybody in our churches needs to be thinking with. Really? 62% of my income is discretionary spending? What are you talking about? It's true. That's an average household. Do we have the resources? This is a map of Anabaptist churches in North America. Our people group is scattered all over the continent, right where we live, where we work, where we go to church, where we provide for our families. Where are those resources going? To serving self or those that Jesus cares about? Let's look at a few other things about our resources. We think this is normal. Our focus on godly families, biblical teaching as a way of life, our Christian schools, our homes. Many times I ask, are we living a Luke 14 home? And what I mean by that, Jesus told us how to make out a guest list: the blind, the crippled, the maimed. And I asked my wife, when's the last time we had a blind person at our dinner table? Is that our home? Is that how we're using our homes? Our businesses, are we more concerned about the other party than ourselves? Informal apprenticeship, training, and trades. We teach our young people how to be carpenters and welders, and you know, the list goes on and on. We think that's normal. That's not normal in the vast majority of the world. We have resources that are hard to fathom. So my question is, what are we aiming for? What is the good life? How do we define the good life? Is it like the American dream, like the secular culture around us defines a good life? Or is it something different? Is it possible we have been blown off course? Hopefully this teaching tool can help you, if you want to, redefine the good life. So the purpose of this course is simply a tool to help our families and churches become trustworthy stewards. And notice, I don't believe it's possible to arrive there. I believe this is an ongoing battle, especially in a materialistic wealth environment in which we find ourselves. The course should cause us to think critically and wrestle, make choices as a local brotherhood. This course was developed by the SALT program, which works overseas in several dozen countries, and it was born out of coming home and wondering about the poor in our own country. The poor look very different in this country than they do in other places. After a bit here, we'll get into the books a little bit, but there's four tracks. There's a participant guide, which we call, and then there's two tracks for stewardship within. There's track C is designed for our local church, and it focuses on disparity. And track D is for our youth, and it focuses on opportunity. We're going to have a little exercise here in a moment to think about disparity a little bit. But our youth today, they've been taught. They have a biblical worldview. They have money. They can travel. They have unprecedented opportunity. Where are their resources going? There's also two tracks for reaching out to others. Track A, focus on chronic need. Maybe you have an employee that lives paycheck to paycheck and needs a payday loan. Maybe it is someone that is on welfare. So it focuses on chronic need. Track B is the local community, and that is someone that might not come to your church, but maybe is in a divorce situation, a single parent, brokenness, and they both focus on hope. Now, some of you have track C, which is focus on disparity in our own churches, and others have track D, but in the very back of the book, there's a course description. Track C, it's page 385. If you want to, you can go back there. You can get an overview of the whole course. But in short, there's five foundational lessons in the very front of the book, and then there's 30 additional lessons in the back. And those 30 are, there's a whole host of them. There's the A series, which you can cherry pick. So the idea is, you get started with the first five lessons in the front, whether it's youth or your own church, and then you ask whoever's participating in it, what do you want to study next? And there's a broad range of topics. A series can be studied in any order. The B series focuses on family, money, and marriage. The C is the golden years, going until you're gone. And then there's work chapters. Sometimes a young man struggles to hold a job, or they view work as drudgery rather than a blessing. Somebody said earlier today, work is a blessing, and that's something we own as a people group. And then there's five or six chapters on business, from starting a business to transparency with the local brotherhood, and really reevaluate the purpose of business. The course design, we call it a facilitator, not a teacher. We're learning together, a participant, not student. It's participatory, not lecturing. It's dialogue, not monologue. There's open-ended questions. Thinking is required, and it generally avoids do's and don'ts, but offers biblical principles, and you and your brotherhood decide where God is calling you. In fact, we believe if we said, well, let me say it this way. We've had criticism and said, give us more concrete, step 1, 2, 3, 4, so we know what an emergency fund should be as we think at our personal finances. And there's many courses out there that do that, like a Dave Ramsey, a lot of Anabaptism uses that, and it's not all bad. But we believe we should teach biblical principle, ask the hard questions, and you and your brotherhood decide where God is calling you. If we told you what exactly you should give or what exactly it's okay to consume, we believe we'd be getting between you and God. In fact, we want your church, your brotherhood, decide those questions. We're saying, here's what the Bible teaches. What should we do about it? So we're going to work through chapter 1 of track C is what we're going to do. So you can open your books. It's track C and D are both page 9 is where they're at. So we can open there. And again, it's participatory learning rather than lectures, biblical principles rather than fiscal trends, lots of stories to illustrate principles in everyday life, activities and exercise, income and expense tracking. It's also important to know that if you're going to do this in a group setting, we need to have a safe place to learn and ask questions. People can be as transparent or open as whatever's normal in your culture, but have the conversation. Start the conversation. If you go to page 10, it kind of shows you where what we do. There's foundational principles in the front. Both of those are five chapters. And then there's the additional topics. Those additional topics are the same in every track. It's only the foundationals that change. If you go to page 13, track C, chapter 1 focuses on disparity. Track D, chapter 1 focuses on blessed. But what I want to do is demonstrate activities. And what we do, we try to get people out of their seats and have them engaged in activities to learn. This past winter, I taught this the youth's course at a winter Bible school, youth Bible school. And I think I had 30-some students. It was a lot of fun getting the young people engaged, had a lot of good discussions. But there's many activities, and we're going to do this activity here. And you can see chapter one, it kind of what the introductory activity, then discuss disparity. It always starts from the Bible, the big picture, life with Bill and Sarah, and then there's other activities. But at this point, I'd like to do a quick exercise here. I need 10 volunteers. And let's put 7 volunteers on this side. Just stand here, it'll only take a few minutes, and you'll be okay. There'll be something good in it for you. And 3 people on this side. So just go ahead, 7 people come up, 3 people on this side, and I'll show you a little demonstration to demonstrate disparity in the world. Okay, we got some people, 3 people over here. Okay, we got 3 here. Wonderful. So I have a pack of 100 M&Ms. And what I'm going to do is demonstrate you represent the global population is what you represent. This side represents those that are poor, and this side represents those that are wealthy. So of the 100 M&Ms I have 3 of them that will go to this side. So you get 1, Anthony, none for you, Leonard, none for you, Daniel, 1 for you, Chris, 1 for you. Now, I don't know what you're going to do about your neighbor there. They don't have anything. Now, we come over here with these folks, and these are the people are us. This is us. Hold your hands, Japheth. Now, don't drop any. Come on, be careful. Now, you all represent, if you have more than $10,000 in everything you own in this world, house, vehicle, whatever, money, savings, you're on this side. $10,000. My guess is everybody in this room is over here. If you're on that side, there's just not enough. Now, I don't know how you feel about this, but as I wrestle through this wealth that God has poured into my life, what would please God today? Now, so I did this exercise once, and the people on this side cut their candies in half and gave it to their neighbor. What do you guys feel? Say again?
I wish I liked
M&Ms. You wish you liked M&Ms. Okay, you can share with your neighbors. You can go back to your seats. Thank you. So the course has all kinds of activities. In the youth book, there's an activity called Take a Step, and everybody in the class lines up. And then there's questions, and they either take steps forwards or backwards. And by the time the exercise is done, all of us in this room are way on the upper side, and everybody, the poor, are way back here, and they're scattered across the room. So there's activities like that to get people, wait, this is true? You can read the words, but they don't connect. But if you can see a little activity, sometimes it helps connect. So I'm working from track C. If you have a track D book, you can follow along in principle. So we start with an activity, and if you flip the page to page 15, there's always a from the Bible. And this account is, again, we're focused on disparity, is about Lazarus and the rich man. And I'll just read the little phrase there below the artwork, next to the art. Jesus shared this sobering account with his Jewish audience, revealing God's heartbeat for his people and their resources. There's much this story does not say, but a few details in this account indicate expectations of those who have resources. We ignore them at our peril. So, yeah, someone reads the Bible, and then there's a brief commentary. Also, I'll say this. The Bible versions that we chose is the New King James. And for people that aren't familiar with the Bible, if you're reaching out, but we're not, and the scripture references are always there. So if you want to use a different version, just bring your Bibles to the course, and you can just read directly from the scripture because of the version that you would like. So then after, we start with from the Bible, then there's discovering the principal questions. And these are simply, there's no yes or no questions. There's no questions that are easy to answer. They're actually questions that are multiple right answers and multiple wrong answers. But yeah, so the last one there says, does Lazarus live among us today? Describe the disparity that you have observed around you. I know in my own life, I grew up in West Central Pennsylvania my whole life, and other than living in Asia parts of the last 10 years, that's where I lived. And it wasn't until I started working overseas that I started seeing the poor around me. And I'd like to suggest in most communities in America, there are poor. Those that would define an alms fund, there's many around us. I think it's easy to miss them. And then each chapter is, I'm just going through what a chapter layout is, the big picture story. That is a true story. And I think I'm going to take the time to read it. It says, Trey was raised in the ghettos of Detroit and was exposed to drugs and dealers from a young age. He worked as a drug dealer and spent time in jail on probation. No one taught him how to work or handle money, and he struggled to hold a job. Trey rescued a young lady named Haley from a drug deal. Soon after that, he married her. She used drugs to escape the pain of a childhood marred by abuse from her father, who was a pastor. For a while, Trey worked as a chef, but his poor work ethic and lack of financial training placed the burden of paying the bills on his wife. He often retreated to his attic bedroom, only coming downstairs to work or eat. During one argument, Haley stabbed Trey in the arm with a knife, and she was sent to a mental hospital for a month. Haley's fights and frustration with Trey compounded her pain and the hurt inside, pushing her deeper into drug use and depression. Perhaps you've encountered a Trey and Haley in the grocery aisle at Walmart and nodded a greeting to them as you passed. Maybe they filled their car with gas at the pump across from you. You knew their background was different from yours, but you never realized how different. What did they do to deserve all this pain? Why is your story, my story, so different from theirs? You know, there's one line in this true story where she was, she tried to escape the pain of a childhood marred by abuse from her father. Now, I know that happens, but someone that is a representative of Christ Church, a minister in the church, did that. I know this situation firsthand, and for years this young lady could not believe that there is such a thing as a good God, because all her authorities were very ungodly. So we go through the big picture, then there's question. Now it's understanding the principle question. After the Bible was discovering the principle, then there's understanding the principle there on page 17. And then there's life with Bill and Sarah. And life with Bill and Sarah is simply a couple with dilemmas. We have all kinds of dilemmas that we run into that align with the topic being taught. And then there's applying the principle questions. So that is the course. Each chapter kind of follows that layout. And then there's other activities as well. Like, for example, here's a little thinking about what we have. Access to clean drinking water. 16% have no source of clean drinking water. Access to toilets. 60% have no toilet available in their entire community. Earn more than $10 a day. 80% of the world's population earns less than $10 a day. Owns a personal vehicle. 91% do not own a personal vehicle, and more. But this is just is this true? If you grew up in an Anabaptist community, you probably don't think about these things very much, but it is true. It's a way to engage people and help them think critically. Then there's a summary with some overarching questions. And then anytime we're working with finances, you deacons would know this. If you stay wishy-washy, you never really get anywhere. So this course has worksheets in the back to track income and expenses. So the idea is, as you work with people and walk through, each of us can see, where's my money flowing? That's step one. Where is my money going? And there's continual pressure to skip this step. It's like, I don't need that. We can just keep going through the course. But I can tell you this from experience of the last, 8 years in working with this, unless we track our income and expenses, we struggle to put it into practical application. So for those of us that God has poured resources and blessings into, it's like, wait a minute, maybe my giving should look different. And maybe I don't need that. Just because I can afford it is not the element of whether I should buy it or not. So this is an important step. And again, in the front of the book, there's 5 chapters that are foundation, then all 30 chapters in the back are the same in every track, and you cherry pick. And the goal is to start slow, do a little bit, and keep doing it. We'll talk a little bit more later on some ways. So So I've given a quick overview of the course. Excited, confused, is this possible to be used in your communities, in your church? Any thoughts at this point? You must all be really confused. Okay, you're excited? Yeah, he has some experience with the course, but again, it's not the solution, it's a solution. Again, I want to be very real with that. There's most of all, we need each other and wrestling and having these difficult conversations. The facilitator guide, you don't need to open the book, but I'll just mention a few things. So in this same chapter we just looked at, the participant guide page has shrunk down. It's only about two-thirds the size, and there's additional information around it, what the focus on the chapter is. In this case, to realize the great disparity in our world and to consider what God might have in mind. And it tells you the supplies you need. You need 100 M&Ms because that's in that exercise. We did, in a youth Bible school, we were demonstrating debt or loans for youth. And, you know, youth are quick to buy vehicles and maybe they can use a loan for it. We did this demonstration. We had one guy had 2 5-gallon buckets full of sand or rocks. Other guy had one of them, and the other guy had just a few rocks in the bottom, and the other guy didn't have anything. Then we did a foot race. They ran all the way out and back. And when the guy without any not carrying anything, he beat the race, and then everybody else stopped. The guy with the 2 heavy buckets of debt, he was way out there. So that was a good illustration or demonstration to show youth, hey, debt is actually a burden. Not all debt's the same, but yeah. And then there's also additional information around the page for the person moderating or facilitating the course. I think it's important that whoever is moderating or facilitating is also a learner. You know, that's the idea, be an humble learner as we walk through this. So removing blockers for you to get started at home. You know, I've been working on this for a long time, and after a seminar like this, I talk to people, we're really excited, we're going to go do this. And then I run into him a couple years later, and he said, yeah, we got busy and we never did anything. And so what I'm pondering right now is how many of your books are going to become dust collectors that the foundation gave to you, and how many are you actually going to use them? So I'm not trying to be harsh, but the idea is, how can we remove blockers? There's many ways to use it. And I think one of the first things is let's not think about figuring this out and checking the box and moving on, but let's think of way of life, slow and steady. This winter, when we have time, we'll do something. And keep repeating. I've noticed in my own life, as much as I've taught and written on this subject, I need it as much as anybody. So start with the foundational chapters in the front of the book. Start with something easy. And then let the brotherhood, let those that you're working with pick the additional topic. What do they want to talk about? When I did that youth Bible school thing, the young man, hey, I want to study how to start a business. And the lady said they want to do this. And so it was great because we were spending time on things they wanted to learn. So if things they want to learn, then they're engaged. And the goal is to learn in bite-sized chunks, allowing the local congregation, the local brotherhood, your home conversation with the Word of God and Holy Spirit guidance to work through it. So there's many venues. It depends on our churches, but some of us have midweek services, winter Bible school, summer Bible school, youth Bible school. Could be small groups, interested homes, families, employee lunchrooms, conference rooms. There's many ways. So I'd like to move on now to think about our worldview. I think it's important to note that changing a worldview takes time. And you may have seen this graphic before, but it's what we sometimes call the cultural onion. And the cultural onion, the very center, the very core, is our ultimate allegiance. On the outside is maybe what I can see, how you're dressed. Sometimes we had a brother from a non-Anabaptist background come into our church. He fits well, he's comfortable. But yet, when you get into deep conversations, you soon learn that his feelings and values and beliefs are quite different. He's a godly man that cares, very open and transparent. But we have to remember, it takes time. We are trying to change the normal in terms of wealth flowing to ourselves and rather have them go to the alms fund, to the poor around us. And that will take time, and we shouldn't be discouraged if it goes slowly or if we have false starts. Let's keep trying again. It's going to take time. I think it's an important thing that I'm trying to get across. And this course uses adult learning methods. Teaching adults is very different than teaching a primary student reading and writing and math. So if it's not relevant to my life and an adult learner, then I'm not going to engage. So we have to make it, get people engaged. They can't be inactive participants. But this ongoing teaching, there's thinking and wrestling, think multiple years, and keep talking about how do we define the good life? What is the good life? What are we actually after? How would we define that? And then perhaps a list of do's and don'ts are of limited value in changing ultimate allegiance. I think we can get artifacts and behaviors and feelings, we can get those things to change easier. But deep within our hearts, the ultimate allegiance, that's going to require God to work in people's lives. It's going to require people to look inward and say, really? Maybe my whole paycheck isn't for me. And maybe it is. Maybe God has something else in mind. Why am I only spending 8% of my income on food? And in other places, they're spending 60%. Why? None of us chose where we were going to be born, but what would please God now? The local brotherhood has the gifts needed. An outsider is not required. The local church and its leaders are Jesus' primary method. You brothers are called in your role by God and your brotherhood, and it is your work. This course is easy to use. It's intuitive. Adapt it to many environments. And don't feel like you can skip this and add that. Do whatever you want to get the ultimate allegiance, to actually steward our wealth well. The facilitator guide helps a brother leading the study. Now, I'd like to point out one other, what I believe is a helpful truth. And can we pour energy into serving those around us? Track C and D are for within. And in my own life, investing in the hurting and the struggling around us, maybe it's an employee, maybe it's a coworker, is a powerful antidote in having our resources flow to the kingdom. From my own experience, this is probably one of the most powerful ways to redefine the good life. And when you run into that, this chronic need, low income, we have track A for that, and we have track B for that. Now, some of us Anabaptists don't have low-income neighbors, but I think it's fair to say that all of us know people that are struggling with broken relationships, perhaps struggling with consumer debt. And in this country, you can hide debt for a very long time with credit cards. So as we try to become better stewards in our homes, our churches, let's never forget who Jesus teaches us to take care of in our local neighborhoods. I would like to conclude with a story. I love history. I really connected with David's topic this morning on the alms fund. And I'd like to look back to the early church, a man named Cyprian of Carthage. This picture of the ruins in northern Africa of Carthage. And Carthage was a Roman citizen. Cyprian was a Roman citizen at the time when Rome ruled the world. He was born into the upper echelons of society in 210 AD. He was wealthy, he was educated, and literally had access to all the world of modern-day Rome had to offer. Now, in spite of all his wealth and ease and opportunity, Cyprian had a problem. His life was empty. He had an inner longing for truth, and it was not until he was middle-aged that he found what he was looking for. He found peace in Jesus Christ. He was baptized at 40 years old, and he was tutored by some of the early church fathers. He became a passionate follower of Jesus. Here is probably the most amazing truth of this story and why I'm sharing it today. Reading Jesus' words on the danger of wealth, he liquidated his entire estate and joyfully gave it to the poor. If we look ahead in his life a little bit, in an unusual move, seeing Cyprian's devotion to the Lord, the church made him a leader within just a few years. In 250 AD, just after he'd been made bishop or elder of Carthage, several waves of persecution hit the city, and Cyprian was forced into hiding. He was eventually captured and beheaded in 258 AD. Now, from the world's perspective, Cyprian's passionate pursuit of truth had been costly. What about you? What about me? As we think about ways to solve our wealth dilemmas, I love studying history and finding little gremlins of faithful people that transcend our culture and our people group that actually took Jesus' teaching seriously. I'll tell you another man. This man's name was Blaise Pascal. He lived in Paris in 1650. And I don't know if you know the story about Blaise Pascal or not. Scientist, mathematician, highly educated. He was a professing Christian, but a nominal Christian. Didn't have a close relationship with the Lord. And one night, the Lord got a hold of this man's heart. And also, he liquidated his assets. In fact, what he did, he took his engineering ingenuity and built a public transportation system in Paris so the poor could get across the city. Paris at that time was sprawling. Again, 1600s. A public transportation system where the poor could use that to get across the city. Got one more. This was in 1980. A young lady lived in Egypt. She was a professing nominal Christian, had tremendous wealth, traveled the world, had a destination wedding in London, had all the world had to offer. In her late teens, early 20s, she said she was intrigued by the poor. And her father said, no, get married and have children. This is what you should do. So she did. But it wasn't long after they were married, she again was convicted that she should pour resources and energy and time into the poor. And she did just that. She was a worldly woman that dressed in all, she'd do shopping trips to Europe, jewelry like you wouldn't imagine. This woman changed her life. She dressed in a simple white dress, got rid of all the jewelry, and she poured her life. She's still alive today. She's in her, I think, 80s. She was born in 1949, so however old that is. And she became known as Mama Maggie. And she poured her life into the Coptic Christian community struggling in the slums of Cairo. And in the slums of Cairo, she found a baby thrown in the garbage. She saw the movement. Her life was completely changed. Rather than serving self and resources flowing to self, she changed her whole life. This past winter, I read this book, all 1,400 pages of it, 1,300 and some. Some of you, I'm certain, recognize it. This is called The Earth is the Lord's. It's by John Landis Ruth. And that is the history of most of us in this room. Starts in Europe with the Amish and the Mennonites, eventually emigrating to America. And there's one overarching theme that is in the history books of our people group, and it's wealth. So my question is, when the history books are written about us in this room a century from now, or two, or three, if the Lord tarries that long, what will the history books say about us? Will there be people among us that take Jesus' teaching seriously about wealth? May God bless you, guide you, and direct you as your congregation, as you seek to become stewards that honor Christ.